This letter was written in Altoona on Wednesday, the 25th of Adar Rishon, 5619. That would be Taf Resh Yud Tes, or 1859, L'misparam. It was written by Rav Yaakov Etlinger, who is the author of the famous commentary on the Talmud Aruch Liner, and he also wrote a two-volume series of Shilos Uchuvos called the Shilos Uchuvos Binyan Tziyun, Building of a Marker. The letter was addressed to Rabbi Mendel Friedlander of Hungary in response to an inquiry that Rabbi Friedlander had posed to the Aruch Liner among other Gedolei Yisrael of the time. And in the letter, the Aruch Liner summarizes in a very dramatic way the Shaila that was posed to him. So I want to just go through the Shaila. And the reason that we're studying this particular question and some of the responses to it today is because a lot of the main back and forth from which the halacha is derived emerges from an analysis of some halachic aspects of Megillas Esther. And so I think that people will find it sufficiently interesting. It's a Purim topic, and it's a very interesting and important topic as well. So let's take a look at the letter. Two Jews lived in a city under my jurisdiction, writes Rabbi Mendel Friedlander of Hungary to the Aruch Liner. They used to go on long business trips, leaving their wives, children, and household help at home. One day, one of them went away as usual, and a man came from Poland with torn clothing and asked the businessman's wife for lodging. She had always been a modest woman, but very naive, and she pitied him and gave him lodging and food and drink. But the guest only drank water and only ate vegan foods. I have to see if this is a makar for veganism. I don't think that this guest is such an exemplary character, so... But Lemaisa, he refused to eat anything that came from an animal. Only vegan foods. He was very abstinent, he denied himself pleasure all day, and isolated himself in his room with the sefer. Every night at Chatzos, he would wail over the Chorban. He refused to sleep on a bed or even on a bench, and would only sleep on the floor with stones as his pillow. Every day he would immerse twice in cold river water. He acted thus from sun truma till Shabbos of Parshas Tetzaveh. Okay, there's a little discrepancy in other accounts of this story, which were other responses from Gedolei Hadar to this question. It's mentioned that it was Parshas Vayakel. So we have to check the calendars. But one way or another, it was sometime around that time of year. And on Friday night, after the children and helpers had gone to bed, and that wily man was sitting alone with the woman at the table, he engaged her in conversation, and she asked him, "Who are you? Where are you from? And where are you headed?" He replied, "I am an agent of Hashem. My name is Eliyahu Hanavi. I have come to gather in the exiles from the four corners of the earth." The woman, in her incredible naivete, believed him. She went to sleep in the next room, leaving that disgusting man looking into a sefer until midnight. At midnight, he tiptoed to the bed where she slept and woke her up and said, "Behold, I have traveled a whole wide world, and I have not found as righteous a woman as you, who is worthy of giving birth to Mashiach. But your husband is not worthy of being the father of Mashiach. So I was sent from heaven to be with you, so at this time next year you'll have a son, and he will be the Mashiach ben David, and he will redeem the Jews. Let this be your sign that I'm truly Eliyahu HaNavi. This Tuesday, after I leave," he told her, "you'll open your bedroom chest and find in it 400 golden ducats." A tremendous fortune in those days. I'm not sure the exact dollar amount. But, that's what it seems like. "You must not open the chest." He's a fake, right? It's, as you notice already, we're progressing. He started out just being a man, and then he turned into a wily man, and he's going to soon metamorphose into much more than that. "But you must not open the chest," he said to her, "until that time." Thus spoke the adulterer. And he seduced her and defiled her twice, once on Friday night and once on Motzai Shabbos. Now here I'm putting an insert This account appears a little bit later in the tshuva. On Shabbos morning, the helpers, the household helpers, came into the woman's bedroom and found the adulterer sleeping on the floor. They found the door unlocked, so they were not impeded from entering. That evidence is important. We may have a chance to discuss why it's important. We might not, but it's there. Before dawn on Sunday, he fled, and his whereabouts are unknown. The naive woman hurried and wrote to her husband to return swiftly home. She believed him when he said that there were going to be 400 golden ducats in the bedroom chest. She believed him. So she wrote to him, "Come home quickly, because Hashem has sent us a great treasure." He believed her. He came home that Tuesday, and she opened the chest, but the treasure the adulterer had promised wasn't there. When she realized he had lied to her, she cried and yelled bitterly. And she told her husband the disgusting thing that evil man had done, and she pleaded with him, "God is my witness that I acted for the sake of heaven, not because I wanted to be unfaithful to you. This adulterer was a disgusting man, very unattractive, and under ordinary circumstances, there's no way anyone would have wanted to be with him." And that's the end of the Shaila that Reb Mendel Friedlander sent to the Aruch Liner.
This are both things you translated.
I was actually...
Just like the nice stuff, that was...
Yes, I was uncertain about it, but I figured that now everyone probably is all excited to find out what the answer is. So that's why it was translated. Now, there's another reason that I translated it as well. The same Shaila appears more briefly in the set of Shailos Utshuvos called the Shailos Utshuvos Shoel Umeshiv that was written by Reb Shaul Netanzan at around the same time. And as I mentioned, Rabbi Friedlander sent this question to a number of the Gedolei Adar, and the Shoel Umeshiv sent him a response. But when the time came to print his tshuvos, the Shoel Umeshiv was unable to find his copy of the response that he sent to Rabbi Friedlander. So what did he do? He wrote the story. He wrote down the story, more abbreviated than the Binyan Tzion wrote it. He wrote it down, and he wrote, and I sent back an answer to Rabbi Mendel Friedlander that the woman was forbidden to her husband, and I gave basically this source and that source, and I lost my original. And then he says, "So why am I writing this to you? If I'm not putting the original in, and I'm just like mentioning the question and mentioning very briefly the answer that I sent, why am I putting this in?" And he answers that he included this story in his Shailos Utshuvos because it's important for people not to be naive. And he was hoping that people, by being exposed to this story in his tshuva sefer, that they would be more on guard against similar types of deception that might possibly be practiced against them.
So let's go over, what's the question?
So we'll get to the question in just a moment. I have one more ha'ara.
And
one more ha'ara that I want to make. I remember that when I first came across this, it reminded me very much of a play that I read in high school. Anyone tell me what the name of the play was? It's actually the name of the play, which was also the name of the protagonist, has become almost like one of those words that are synonymous for this type of story. The name of the play?
Any clues?
No. I think it was called Tartuffe. Tartuffe.
Where did you go to high school?
I didn't say that I read it as part of the high school curriculum.
Spell it.
Tartuffe. Originally a French play, I believe. A very, very similar story. Again, with the moral being that a person is supposed to... Naivete is not a virtue. And the person has to keep their eyes open for deception. So that's why the Shoel Umeshiv put the Shaila into his...
Shabbos.
Especially on Shabbos, yes.
It's Epel Shabbos.
Yeah. So what is the main... What is the crux of the Shaila here? And the way that... There are a number of issues, and I'm only probably going to address one of them today, But the one issue that seems to be most important to address is the following. When this woman did what she did with the noef, with the adulterer, so did she think that what she was doing was an aveira, a rishus, or a mitzvah?
I think she thought it was a mitzvah.
She thought that it was a mitzvah. She thought that Eliyahu HaNavi had come with a divine missive that she was supposed to do this. So when a person is unfaithful to her husband, she knows that she's being unfaithful to her husband, but she believes that to do so is a mitzvah. Or at the very least, she believes that to do so is not a violation of God's will. She's being unfaithful to her husband, but not unfaithful to God. Does that render her forbidden to her husband, or not?
That was the question.
That seems to be the crux of the issue. Right? Do we say that it's the Aveira? When we say that a woman who is unfaithful to her husband, a woman who is an adulteress, that she becomes forbidden to her husband, is it the Aveira that makes her forbidden to her husband? Or is it simply the betrayal of her husband that makes her forbidden to her husband?
Naivete.
Is the intent or the action?
Is it the intent
or
the action? The action was automatic. She thought this man was a tzaddik. This was unknowing to her. She was seduced.
But the end's a problem.
Right.
Really?
We're talking
really?
There are actually a number of different permutations of this Shaila. We'll see in just a moment. So that's one of them. I would say also over here, is the fact that she's forbidden to her husband a punishment for her sin? Or is it a natural consequence of the act that she committed? If it's a punishment for sin, then when there's no sin, when it's a mitzvah, when it's not a sin, she's what could she have done? So then there's no punishment.
She never would have done it if she thought it was a sin. Never.
Precisely.
Never.
But if it's a natural consequence, so then it makes no difference whether the action was permitted or whether the action was forbidden. The natural consequence of being with a man other than her husband is that she's forbidden to her husband.
Maybe it's still a sin, even if she had thought it was good.
Oh, so it's a very important issue. And we'll hopefully get to that in the course of this year as well. Is it
because of her act? Is that the idea, maybe?
That is the question. Her husband approached Rabbi Mendel Friedlander and said, may I stay with my wife, or am I obligated to divorce her? And remember, Mendel Friedlander felt that this was too big of a shaila. The ramifications are too incredible, the possible prohibitions too great for him to deal with on his own, and that's why he sent the shaila to other gedolim. Now, there are a number of similar cases that are found in the literature. We have similar cases. I'll just mention two or three of them.
The Masa Shehaya, you're telling me.
Yeah, the other ones are Masa Shehaya also.
Oh.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
So they're not quite as dramatic as this case, but Lemashal, the Tshuvos Shavus Yaakov, which Rabbi Etlinger, which the Aruch Lener quotes in his response, the Tshuvos Shavus Yaakov deals with the following question. There was once a caravan of Jews, and they were traveling through a forest for whatever reason, and they were attacked by fierce bandits. I think that the Lashon that the Shavus Yaakov uses, it's a very interesting term. I've never seen it anywhere else in Hebrew. Archilistim, the archlistim. Archlistim, together with his loyal followers, and they were attacked by this Archilistim and his followers, and the bandits wanted to kill them all. And there was a very beautiful woman, a married woman, with her husband in that caravan. And she took it upon herself
to save
everybody by seducing the Archilistim and thereby saving the life of the entire caravan. And so that was a very similar question. The woman was doing it. Was it permitted or was it forbidden? Is a machlokas, but the authoritative psak is that it is forbidden. What she was doing was an isser, but it was an isser ba'onis. It was something, right? She's not going to be punished for what she did because she was doing it to save her life. Even though she wasn't allowed to save her life at the expense of violating Gilui Arayos, but the fact is that she was doing it to save her life, and therefore, even though it was forbidden, it's not going to carry a punishment.
It's save the others too, she's doing.
And to save the others as well. That's why it's a machlokes, because some people say that to save a tzibur, to save a city, to save a large group of people, we're more lenient than to save an individual's life.
Right.
The source for that would be, Esther.
Oh, right.
Esther, that's the whole idea.
Right. The source for that would be Esther.
Sacrifice.
That she went to Ahasuerus, and she went willingly, according to some accounts, just in order to save the Jews. So the Nodav Yehuda says, first of all, that may have been because of Ruach HaKodesh, because she was a prophetess. So it could be that she had special permission to do that, that was achieved through divine prophecy. And it could be, says the Nodav Yehuda, and this he likes even better, that to save the entire Jewish nation, because Ahasuerus ruled over 127 provinces, all of the civilized world at the time. And the Jews were only in his provinces, and therefore, if Haman's decree took effect, there would be no Jew who survived. So it was the survival of the entire Jewish nation. So that perhaps justified her sacrifice.
It kind of says that Esther was married to Mordecai, but it never comes down as being a certain thing. Was she married to Mordecai, or was... Was she just his niece or something that he was bringing up?
The Ezra will get there.
The Gemara says
explicitly that she was married to him. Then some Yishonim infer from other statements in the Gemara that she wasn't married to him, and therefore they claim that there's a dispute about whether she was married to him or whether she wasn't married to him. In general, the majority of poskim seem to assume that Esther was married to Mordechai, even though the simple reading of the psukim would indicate that she was not married to Mordechai.
Did she live with him?
According to Midrashi Chazal.
Something that she lived with him. She,
with Mordechai.
She
was married to him. According to Midrashi Chazal, she was married to Mordechai.
Was Yael permitted to her husband?
Oh, so somebody, I want to get to that in a moment. Let me just first finish dealing with Esther, then we'll turn to Yael. So Esther, according to some, what she did was based on Ruach HaKodesh, and therefore cannot serve as precedent for any future circumstance. According to some, she did it to save the entire Jewish nation, and therefore cannot serve as precedent for a woman who's going to do the same action simply to save an isolated caravan of people. Others, however, say that as long as it's to save a significant tzibur, a significant number of Jews, then it's equivalent to Esther's situation, but those are not the most authoritative of responses. The Nodav Yehuda, whose voice carries great weight in halachic discourse, asserts very firmly that it's only to save the entire Jewish nation that such a thing would be permitted. Now, the Nodav Yehuda also mentions the story of Yael, like you mentioned before. And one of the commentaries on the Nodav Yehuda actually brings the following diuk from the psukim. When Devorah is praising the actions of Yael, Devorah the prophetess is praising her actions, Devorah writes, Tivorach minashim Yael, may Yael be blessed from all women. Who's Yael? Eshes Chever HaKeni, the wife of Chever HaKeni. Why is Devorah emphasizing that Yael is the wife of Chever HaKeni? By the emphasis. So I forget which of the commentaries on the Nodav Yehuda writes this. He says, it's to say that even after she did what she did with Sisera, she remained the wife of Chever HaKeni. Chever HaKeni did not need to divorce her, because since what she did was to save the Jewish nation, therefore she remained permitted to her husband. However, we'll see, this is not the Nodav Yehuda himself. This is one of the lesser known commentaries on the Nodav Yehuda, and I think that we'll discover that the fact is that the consensus of poskim believe that Yael would have been forbidden to her husband afterwards. We'll have to deal with that evidence of Eshes Chever HaKeni some other way. But most poskim believe that Yael would have been forbidden to her husband. Esther, in spite of the fact that she did what she did to save the Jewish nation, would have been forbidden to Mordechai afterwards. It's not the intention, that she's doing a mitzvah that she can't help it, it's against her will, that doesn't make a difference. The act, not the sin, the act of being unfaithful to her husband or the act of being with a man other than her husband alone makes her forbidden to her husband.
Yet the simple shot of Yael is that she was not forbidden to her husband.
If you
would, the wife of the husband.
That's what the Shiras Devorah seems to say. Eshes Chever Hakeni, that even afterwards she was his wife.
With the case of Esther, though, this case, the consequences would have to really be factored. There was no going back anyway to Mordecai.
What if Achashverosh had died? What if Achashverosh died?
Remained the king's wife, from that point on. So there was no going back to Mordecai anyway, so it wasn't a factor.
What if Achashverosh had died?
Right. In that case, would have factored in, right? But it didn't happen, so it never came up to that.
He doesn't say he died.
So it's interesting, there are those who want to differentiate between the case of Yael and the case of Esther. See, maybe Yael was permitted to her husband, to Chever HaKeni, and Esther was forbidden to Mordechai. Why? Because in Yael's case, the probability of her zinus saving the Jews was very high. And after all, she knew that if Sisera drained his koach, if he drained all of his strength, that she would be able to murder him. It was very high likelihood of that happening. And therefore, it wasn't as if she was taking a gamble. She was doing something which almost certainly was going to save the Jews. As opposed to Esther, who's to know whether Esther's gamble was going to pay off or not. She was going to go to Achashverosh willingly, and maybe Achashverosh would agree to reverse Haman's decree, but there wasn't that same likelihood. It wasn't like cause and effect. It was a gamble, and therefore, perhaps it was less permitted. The stakes were higher too, right? Some people point out the opposite, that by Sisera, he was already on the run.
Right.
He was already on the run, so he poses a danger to the Jews. He only poses a danger if he's able to muster up a whole nother army and find another opportunity to attack. Right now, he's fleeing. But Esther, there was a clear and present danger, so therefore there was more of a necessity for her to do what she did. So it's very hard, although people try to differentiate between those two cases.
Yael had a relationship with Sisera?
That's what Chazal say. It says, Bein Ragleha, between her legs, Kara, Shachav, Nafal.
After she killed him.
And then afterwards she killed him.
He had to get tired of him.
She stabbed him with a spear.
Right.
Nafal Ben Arga, Kara, Shachav. He's dead. He died. It doesn't say that he had a relationship with her.
It doesn't say it explicitly, and like we wouldn't.
Boaz.
What?
Boaz, כתוב במדרש,
שבע פעמים.
לא, לפני כן. זה היה האפשרות שהוא יכול.
I think the Medrash is bothered. How did she have the strength to assassinate Sisera? He was the strongest warrior of Yavin Melech Hatzor. So where, how did it happen that he fell into such a deep sleep that she was able to smash his...
She gave him milk,
I don't know, I drank milk for breakfast and I'm still awake.
Listen, when you're tired and you come from a war and you drink milk, it's a definite,
Hot milk.
And a bedtime story. And a bedtime story. That does it.
Anyway, let's get
so so the Medrash Chazal they also infer why we're repeating it. It says 7 Bein Raglea Karash Shachav Nafal Bein Raglea Karash Shachav Basher Nafal Sham Basher Shachav Sham Nafal Shadud. So many falling Bein Raglea Shachav. Chazal understand that there's an allusion here to something which we didn't want to say explicitly in the Psukim, but which we had a tradition that it took place. That she did that in order to weaken him so that she could be absolutely certain that he wouldn't wake up before her assassination was completed. So you can go back and forth in terms of Yael and in terms of Esther. You could say that maybe when the probability of saving the Jews is very high, and the probability of the Jews' annihilation, if this is not done, is very high also. So perhaps, if a woman under those circumstances were to be with a man other than her husband, it would be permitted, but that's a very, even that is a somewhat difficult thing to say.
A little murky.
Yes. So let me just mention one other case that we have so far, the case of the Aruch Lener. We have the case of the Shvus Yaakov about the woman who was Mizana with the arch listim in order to save the caravan. We have the case of Esther and Yael, obviously. There's one other case which is very interesting. It's dealt with by the Sridei Eish, Bichil Yaakov Weinberg. And he writes about a case where a woman grew up totally ignorant of halacha, and she thought that a civil divorce counts as a halachic divorce. She got married halachically, divorced civilly, and then she got remarried to a second man. So she was still halachically married to her original husband, but when she's with that second man, she's totally oblivious to the fact that she's committing adultery according to halacha. She thinks that what she's doing is entirely permissible. And so therefore, again, you have a case where a woman thinks that she's doing, if not a mitzvah, at least something that is entirely 100% permissible, right? But at the same time, halakhically, she's with a man other than her husband. Do we follow the intention to sin? Do we say that her being forbidden to her, and obviously the second man died and she wanted to go back to the first one, and do we say that it's the intention to sin which is punished by prohibition to her original husband? In which case here, where there's no intention to sin, perhaps she should be permitted? Or do we say, no, it's a natural consequence. If she's with a man other than her husband, then she's automatically forbidden regardless of her intentions. So there you have a couple of different variations. Again, that case is a slightly different as well because it's a case not where she thought it was a mitzvah, but rather she thought it was a rishus. She thought it was permissible. So you don't have the same level of noble intentions. It was simply the absence of ignoble intentions. And all of these differences might make a difference. So now let's turn for a moment and see some of the classical analysis, a lot of which we have already spoken out in response to everyone's comments. So first of all, we have here the Gemara in Maseches Megillah. And the Gemara in Maseches Megillah tells us that Esther sends to Mordechai, "Uvechein avo el ha-melech asher lo chados," I'm going to go against the law, in other words, against halacha, "v'chasher avadti avadti." And the Gemara comments, what does this mean? I'm going to go against the law. Shalom kidas haya. It's going to go against the law. Shebekal yom v'yom ad achshav. Every day until now, be'ones. I don't go to Achashverosh. He comes and he grabs me and I can't resist. It's imposed upon me against my will, says Esther. Ve'achshav, but now, biratzon. I'm going to go, biratzon. I'm going to go willingly. Therefore, says Esther, v'chasher avadti avadti, I'm going to be lost. Just like I was lost, kashim she'avadti mi beis abba. Just like I was lost to my family, kach ovad mi meich. So too I will be lost to you, Mordechai. It's such a sweet romantic story. She's married to Mordechai, and then she's kidnapped by the mighty king of the 127 provinces. But you know, she remains loyal and faithful and loving to her original husband in spite of being kidnapped by this powerful king. But now, to save the Jews, she says, you know, I remain loyal to you in my heart, but I'm not going to be able to remain physically loyal to you anymore because the salvation of the Jews takes precedence. That's paramount.
I read somewhere that she didn't have relations.
Yes, somebody says that she conjured up some sort of a demon to send in her place, and there's interesting theories like that.
It's a very good question. Very good question.
No, it's brought down. It's such a thing is brought down in this farm, but
that I agree to.
You agree to that?
Because they had a son. Proof. You can ask. You know.
Right? Maybe it was Mordechai's son. It was Mordechai's son. Just that everyone thought it was. You can. There's lots of things that you can say. They're cute, but it's not very convincing.
It's like that other guy we talk about.
Yeah.
We don't talk about.
Yeah. So then the Gemara continues and says, "Vayihi bayoyim ashlishi," that it came the appointed day, "vatilbash Esther malchus," and Esther dressed herself in royalty. So the Gemara is concerned. Big day malchus mi boile. It should have said she dressed in royal clothing. What does it mean she dressed in malchus, in royalty? So Rabbi Elazar says in the name of Rabbi Chanina, milamed shalav shasa ruach hakodesh, that she dressed in divine inspiration. She dressed in a spirit of prophecy. As it says, but here, Vatilbash, Ksiv Hasam, Viruach, Lav Shayas Amasai, that the Ruach HaKodesh, the divine spirit, can clothe a person, can enrobe and envelop a person. Vatamod Bechatzar Beis HaMelech HaPnimis, she stood in the inner courtyard. What does it mean she stood? Vatamod. Amida can mean one of two things. It could mean simply standing as opposed to sitting, but Amida can also mean pausing, standing as opposed to walking. So Chazal are sensitive to this dual meaning of Vata Amod, and they say it means that as she was walking towards Achashverosh, she paused, she stood still while she was walking. Amar Rabbi Levi. Rabbi Levi explains, Kivan Shehigia the Beis Hatzlamim, when she got to the shrine where Achashverosh worshipped, Nistalka Himeno Shechina, the Shechina, the Ruach HaKodesh, that had accompanied her until then, flew away. It disappeared. It vanished. Amra, she said, Kaili, Kaili, Lama Azavtani, God, why have you abandoned me? Your spirit was with me up until this point, and now your spirit has departed from me. Why have you abandoned me? Shema Ata Don Al Shogi Kemezid? Perhaps you consider a person who is doing it by accident, unintentionally, the same as one who does it intentionally? I'm not going here of my own free will. I'm going here because circumstances have forced me to this place. And Shema Atadon Al Ones Kiratzon. Perhaps you judge a person who is compelled, who is forced, who has no choice in the matter, as one who does it of her own free will. So there...
It's
a figure of speech. Sometimes shogeg does mean ones, and sometimes ones means shogeg. It is a figure of speech, but over here she's describing herself. How is it? Achshav biratzon every day until now beones and now biratzon, or is it now also beones? How is she describing herself here in this later statement? She's saying she's an ones. So a few lines earlier, she said to Mordechai, I'm going to be a ratzon now. I'm going to do it willingly. And now she's saying, on her way to do it, she changed her mind. She had a reversal of opinion. There seems to be a contradiction here between Esther's descriptions of her own conduct. First, she describes herself as going willingly, and later she describes herself as going unwillingly.
She's
and
willing to be forced. Willing to succumb to be forced. So it was really not, I don't think, a contradiction.
At this point, she wasn't forced.
At this point, so she tells Mordechai, I'm going to go Beratzon, and I'm going to be forbidden to you. Yes. I'm going to be forbidden to you. And now she says, God, I'm going Beones. So how should she be permitted to Mordechai or forbidden to Mordechai? If she's calling herself an Ones, then you would expect her to be permitted to Mordechai, but she just told Mordechai, no, I'm going to go Biratzon, I'm going to be forbidden to you. So which one is it? Meaning, I understand that there are elements of both involved here, and there's a number of different ways to describe which elements are the Ones elements and which elements are the Ratzon elements, but the fact is that, halakhically speaking, we need to know, will she be permitted to Mordechai afterwards? Will we treat her as being Ne'ensa? Or will we prohibit her to Mordechai afterwards and treat her as being Biratzon.
Is there such thing as being forced by the situation as opposed to being forced at gunpoint? Or is that the Yitzhar?
That's a situation to gunpoint.
Let me make a slightly different differentiation. I mean, there are different gradations of being forced. What some people discuss is being forced, having somebody grab her and do it to her no matter how much she resists, as opposed to somebody saying, you have a choice. You can either die or you can do this. You can either have your nation exterminated or you can do this. So there's a choice. It's not a very evenly balanced choice, but at least it's not the only option that's open to her. And that is a distinction that that post can draw.
Was that said to her? Or did she have that feeling?
It was implicit. If I don't go, so then the Jews will be exterminated. And if I go, so then there's a chance of saving them. So she seemed to have had a choice. Mordechai told her to go. Right? Mordechai told her to go. Right? Which we'll get to in a moment as well. That complicates matters a lot more. But it certainly seems, and I think everyone agrees, that what Esther did was not only permitted, but it was a mitzvah. But because of this question, it could be that it's not the sin which leads to the punishment of her being forbidden to her husband. It's the action, the natural consequence of what she did is that she's forbidden to her husband. It has nothing to do with whether that action is a sin or whether it's a mitzvah. The fact is that a woman who's with a man other than her husband becomes forbidden to her husband regardless of whether that's a mitzvah or not.
I mean, just a little different case which maybe clarify. It's not permissible to commit suicide. When a soldier jumps on a grenade to save his men, is it onus or is it rough?
And yet, during Hitler, was considered a mitzvah to commit suicide. The girls in the Beis Yaakov, that was considered a mitzvah. They all committed suicide.
The Crusades did the same.
Right. Correct.
I understand.
You're right.
Maybe to save other people, you're not.
Yeah. So I want to know if owners are wrong.
He's got a good point, Rebbe.
When a soldier jumps on a grenade to save other people, first of all, I think that you could give a whole shiur on the permissibility of that. I actually think that it would be permitted. I don't think that that's an avera at all. I think it's a mitzvah.
To save another life.
Now, for a person to give his life in order to save someone else's life, that we don't usually say that that's true. But I remember I once had this shaila. My wife was teaching a class, and she somehow this question came up in the class, and I asked the question to Rabbi Schechter, and the question went as follows. So let's say that you have 20 people in a lifeboat, and the lifeboat is not able to hold the weight of 20 people, and so somebody has to jump off. So how does that get done? Can they force somebody to jump off? Can they not force somebody to jump off, even though they're all going to go down? If they could force somebody to jump off, does it make a difference who takes precedence? What if there's somebody who weighs as much as two other people? So I think that what Rabbi Schechter told me is that it's a midas chasidus. Whoever jumps off the boat, it's a midas chasidus. It's doing something righteous because it's going to save the other 19 people. But to force somebody off the boat, I don't think they're allowed to do that. But if whoever does jump off the boat, it's a midas chasidus. So I think that the soldier with the grenade is a similar situation. And there are circumstances where a person's allowed to give up their life for various reasons. But what she's doing is not just giving up her life. It's adultery. It's not just suicide. Suicide, it's not clear whether that's abizrayu deritzicha or not. It's a prohibition, but violating Shabbos is also a prohibition. We're allowed to violate Shabbos to save lives, even to save one person's life. But there are three averos, gilei arayos, avodah zarah, shfichus damim, which we have to give up our lives rather than save our lives at the expense, and this is Gilui Arayos. It seems to be Gilui Arayos. Yes, Alvin?
No, I was thinking a few things. You said before, it depends upon the amount of people saved.
No, one-to-one, you are not allowed.
But the woman and the bandits, remember you said it?
Yes.
The principal size of the community, which is going to be saved. And then, the story, but the soldier that sacrificed himself to save his comrades from a hand grenade, you didn't say anything about the amount of people being saved. It was probably a few people only that he saved, you know, but it wasn't, you know, 25, 30, 50,000 people that he saved.
Right.
You know, and something else came to mind too. You know, I guess that the thing she did for, you know, was It was similar, I think, in a like on a different level to what the way the Draco food
Yaakov?
This guy, with the with birthright. If you could equate that with adultery, for the greater good, because it had to be done for things to turn out the way they had to turn out, then they're in the touring movie. That's a different dimension that it gives it me.
Right, I hear what you're saying, but I think that that the answer to that might be very similar to what I mentioned to Mr. Rendell before also, which is that we have to differentiate between the severity of the Aveira that's being performed. There are, deceit is an Aveira, and violating Shabbos is an Aveira, and committing suicide is an Aveira, but those are not from the three cardinal sins.
Right.
Three cardinal sins are a totally different level of Aveira. A totally different level. According to the Ran says that Mordechai, when he refused to bow down to Haman, he knew that it was going to endanger all of Klal Yisrael.
Right.
But he refused anyhow because he felt that the three cardinal sins are so severe that even if one is endangering all of Klal Yisrael by refusing to violate, one's supposed to endanger. I guess he had a change of mind when he told Esther, to do what she did. But at least originally, he seemed to think three cardinal sins, avodah zara. It's so severe that you cannot violate it, even if it means that the whole fate of the Jewish nation hangs in balance.
But on the other hand, when it comes to kashrut, if no kosher food available and if you're starving to death, God forbid, it's okay to eat not kosher food,
Like the soldiers of World War II.
Right, because that particular Aveira is a less severe. It's a less severe Aveira.
Ate that or ate nothing.
But if
we mentioned at the beginning that there's a controversy about it. The psukim don't seem to mention it. Chazal seem to mention it in a number of different places. And Rishonim infer from other places in Chazal that there's a machlokas amongst different chachamim about it. The poskim seem to accept, at least for the purposes of deriving halacha from the Megillah narrative, they seem to accept that Esther was married to Mordechai. Yes?
Is it possible that initially he was beratzam with the Shekhinah, then the Shekhinah leaves her, and then she becomes honest? Because at that point, she was guided by the Shekhinah all this time. The Shekhinah leaves, and now she has no choice. She's actually standing there with the Hashverish. And at that point, she becomes an onus.
Meaning she started going with the intention
because
that
she was guided by the Shekhinah. With Russell.
And then at the last minute, so now she loses the divine guidance, so she doesn't know whether to go or whether not to go. So she's about to run away, and Achashverosh comes and grabs her. And
in a moment of weakness,
interesting.
Transitional moment. Yeah.
I think I saw someone who said a similar pshat, a little bit different though, but very similar. He wanted to say that what she did at that moment with Achashverosh was perfectly okay, because it was to save the Jews, and that was considered an ones. But she was in a dilemma afterwards, because if she, keep in mind, she had been married to Ahasuerus for a while, and she never ever went to him willingly. Now, suddenly, she has a change of heart, and she goes to him willingly, and he's probably ecstatic, and, and happens to be that, that right after that, she has a special request from him that he should execute Haman, reverse the decree, promote Mordechai to being the prime minister. Now, what's going to happen if she goes back, she reverts to her original type of conduct, and she refuses anymore to be... So Achashverosh is going to start thinking, one second here, have I been manipulated? Have I been duped? Precisely. So in order to preserve the dividends of her conduct now, she had to be beratzon in future times as well. And someone's medayik from Rashi, then maybe that's what it means, that she was beratzon. This particular time was mutter, but the later times, where again the connection between what she did and the salvation of the Jews is much more tenuous, so then perhaps she would be forbidden to Mordechai because of those times.
Do the ends justify the means, in other words?
Yeah, that's another permutation of the Shaila. It's a very rich conceptual question. So there are many, many different conceptual issues that all relate to the same question, to the same set of questions. Is it intention versus action, and the ends versus the means, and the sin versus the automatic consequence. So let's, in the time remaining to us, let us look at a little bit of what's been written about this. If we finish very little of it, so then perhaps we'll continue on Monday. Otherwise, we'll find something else to do on Monday. So the basic beginning of all discussions is a tshuva of the Maharik. And the Maharik, we'll read here the underlined, he says, Hagarsina bin Megillah Perakama, the first parak of Megillah that we just read, Kasher Avadti Avadti, Kasher Avadti mi Beis Abba, Avadti mi Meich. The Ad Hashta Be'ones, Vashta Be'ratzon. Shema Mina, says the Mariik. The Me'osa Shah, from that moment, Ne'esro al Mardachi. She became forbidden to Mardachi. She said, I'm going Be'ratzon. She says, Avadti mi Meich, I'm no longer allowed to be with you. V'ini Dover Pashotu, he says the Mariik. It's Pashot. Yoser mi be'asa b'kutcha. It's more pashut than the fact that eggs are parv. More pashut than that. Ki Esther lo asa shum iser. That Esther didn't violate any avera. She didn't transgress anything by going to Achashverosh.
Beforehand.
Beforehand. Velo haya b'davra. There isn't even a tiny bit of avera. Ella, mitzvah rabba asasa. She did a big mitzvah, she sila called Israel, that she saved all the Jews. And then he quotes as evidence for that a comment of Tosos Rabbi Yehuda of Paris. Next underline, davar zeh mutar lasos. This is permitted to do, avera zo lishma. This avera is done for the sake of heaven. Afilu hi eishas ish, even if she's an eishas ish. Kedei lahatzil kol Yisrael, because it was done to save all the Jews. V'chein matzinu be'Esther. We find this by Esther. Shehim tzia atzma l'achashverosh b'shah shalo haya tov'ah. That she made herself available to Achashverosh, even though he didn't demand her. Kedei sheyis avela, in order to excite his passion for her. V'yi yenoach lihis patos, in order to make him easier, more pliable, to seduce la'asos la'bakashasa, to fulfill her request of saving the Jews. So this is this avera lishma. It's a sugya unto itself, a big sugya unto itself, and it applies. It basically, Yael is the paradigm of avera lishma. That it wasn't avera; it was being unfaithful to her husband. I thought it was being done for the sake of heaven. In the time of Yael, nobody knew that there was such a heter. Afterwards, there was a prophecy, Devorah HaNeviah, or maybe it became more widely known that such things were permitted to save the entire Jewish nation. But Yael herself did not know. She thought that she was doing an Avera. We'll see in a moment. There's a slight twist on that we'll see in a moment in the Binyan Sion. But it's clear from the Maharik two things. Number one, the Maharik, and we don't have time to go into the rest of his proofs about why Esther was doing a mitzvah and not an Avera. But it's clear from the Maharik that he says that Esther was doing a mitzvah. It wasn't that she just believed that she was doing a mitzvah. She was actually doing a mitzvah, but she nonetheless had to shoulder the consequences of being forbidden to Mordechai, because it's an outcome of the action, not an outcome of the sin. It's not a punishment from the sin that she becomes forbidden to Mordechai. It's just a natural result of a woman being with a man other than her husband. However, the Binyan Sion, right? We began this year with the Binyan Sion, La'arach Laner, Rabbi Yaakov Etlinger. He was the one who posed this Shaila. And in his response to the Shaila, he makes the following bold argument against the Maharik, which is a very, very bold thing to do, because the Maharik lived centuries before the Aruch Liner, and it's very unusual for someone who lived so much later to argue on someone who lived so much earlier. And it's not just someone living later arguing on someone earlier. The Maharik's rulings are codified in almost every single siman of Shulchan Aruch. He's very, very authoritative. The Ramah, the Shulchan Aruch, took the Maharik incredibly seriously. So that means that what the Maharik says is invested with a tremendous amount of halachic weight. And the fact is, if you look in the Sifrei HaPoskim, in the commentaries on Shulchan Aruch, the Ramah quotes this Maharik as halacha in the Shulchan Aruch, and the Beis Shmuel quotes it as halacha. That's what it seems to be. And so what the Binyan Siyun is doing, he's not basing himself only on this. He wants to differentiate between his case and the case of the Maharik. But he's also, what he's doing is, he's saying, first of all, that Maharik's arguments are, at least in this connection, somewhat weak. The fact is that we're not able to push them aside entirely because the Ramah and the Beis Shmuel codified them, so we have to accept their authority. But we are able, perhaps, if our case is slightly different from the case of the Maharik, then perhaps we can say that even the Maharik would have permitted the woman in this case. So right now I'm not going to focus on the differences between the case of the Aruch Liner and the case of the Maharik, but rather I'm going to focus on the Aruch Liner's analysis of what took place, what transpired between Esther and Mordechai and Achashverosh. And he says the following. I'm reading now the underline in the Tshuvos Binyan Tzion. Lo shayich zeh, rak bezinsa beratzon, the only time that she's forbidden to her husband is when she was mizane beratzon, viniskavna lehana asa, and she intended to get pleasure, meaning she thought it was permitted to get pleasure from a man other than her husband. Ela shelo yada she'isaru, but she didn't know that it was forbidden. Shemikamakom niskavna limol bebaila, because in the end of the day she intended to betray, to be unfaithful to her husband, just she didn't realize that there was a sin. Aval bezinsa l'shem mitzvah, when a person is mizana l'shem mitzvah, she thinks that it's actually what God wants, shekavanasa rak l'shem shemayim, her whole intention is for the sake of heaven, heyach yikra zeh shema'ala b'bayla. How can you call this being unfaithful to her husband? Her husband wants her to do God's will, she wants to do God's will. This is not even a betrayal of her husband. And then he says, and take a look, b'yoser yikshagabi Mordechai. You have this question particularly with regard to Mordechai. Shehu be'atzmo tziva lo, lavo el ha-melech. Mordechai, Esther's husband, commanded her to be unfaithful to him and to go to the king. Right. So how can you call this, it's not a betrayal of God, because it's a mitzvah gedola, and it's not either a betrayal of her husband, says the Binyan Sion, because her husband told her to do this. Neged ritzona, v'heyach techashiv shema'ala bomal. So how can we say that she betrayed him? So what are we going to do with the Gemara? The Gemara says, kasher avadti avadti, I'm going to be lost to you, I'm going to be forbidden to you. So the Binyan Siyun, again, has this really incredible reading of the Gemara. And he says, this is very similar to what you were saying before. Esther and Mordechai, he says, weren't sure. They didn't know whether this action was going to bring about the salvation of the Jews, or whether it would not bring about the salvation of the Jews. Either this will do it, or Revach Vatzala Yamod LaYehudim Mimakom Acher, it'll come from someplace else. They weren't sure. If the action ultimately leads to the salvation of the Jews, so then it's clear God saved the Jews through the medium of this action. So obviously, retroactively, we understand that the action was permitted. And if God doesn't save the Jews through the medium of this action, and he saves them mimakom acher, so then retroactively we'll understand that the action was forbidden. It's a gamble. Esther and Mordechai agree that she's going to take a gamble. She's going to do something. Now obviously, safek nefashos. And let's say there's a patient, and the patient is in danger, and the doctor is not sure whether he'll get there on time. So he's going to take a gamble. If he gets there on time, he'll save the patient, and that'll justify his Chilul Shabbos. If he doesn't get there on time, and he doesn't save the patient, well, it'll justify his Chilul Shabbos anyhow, because a person is allowed to and is supposed to gamble in order to save lives, when it's Chilul Shabbos, to save an individual life, and with Gilead Royos, to save the life of all the Jews everywhere. I want to finish by 10:30. So that is a permissible gamble. So Esther says, look, I know that by going to Achashverosh, I'm allowed to go to Achashverosh. There's no question about it. I'm allowed to go. This is a gamble that I'm obligated to take. But if the gamble succeeds, so then it will be clear that everything that I was doing was being done with divine consent, and I'm permitted to Mordechai. And if the gamble fails, if the Revach and Hatzalah come from someplace else, then it'll be clear that God did not smile on this particular Hishtadlos, and therefore I will be forbidden to Mordechai. So when she sends a message to Mordechai, Kasher Avadti Avadti, she's saying to Mordechai, I'm taking a chance. It could be that I'll be lost to you. It could be, if God doesn't smile on our venture. Then, says the Binyan Sion, and this coming back to the contradiction where Esther describes herself as Be'onis and also describes herself as Beratzon, she's walking past Achashverosh's shrine, past his temple, past the place where he worships, and suddenly, poof, the divine inspiration disappears. And she turns to God and says, is this the sign? Is this the sign that my venture, that my efforts are not being graced with divine favor? Is this the sign that the Revach and Hatzalah are not supposed to come through me, through this particular plan, but rather from another source? Is this the sign that I'm going to be forbidden, right, to my husband? I think that I'm an ones. I wouldn't have started out unless I felt that there was a good chance that this would succeed. So God, why are you treating me like a ratzon? Why are you making me into a ratzon? Really, I'm just an ones. So that's how the Binyan Sion reads it. He says, it's true, there was a chance that she would have been forbidden to her husband. There was a chance that she would be forbidden to Mordechai. That's what she means, kasher avadti avadti. But in the end of the day, because she succeeded, therefore, says the Binyan Sion, she's permitted to Mardechi. So in the end of the day, we haven't had a chance to see this, no Rabbi Yehuda, but in the end of the day, the Binyan Sion says that there are a number of grounds for permitting this naive woman, whom we encountered at the outset of this year, there are a number of grounds for permitting her to remain with her husband. And the Binyan Sion's conclusion is that the Marik, his argument can be neutralized. The Marik's proof from Esther and Mordechai, there are ways to neutralize it. However, because the Marik is so authoritative, so we're not going to stand up and oppose the Marik. The Ramah codified the Marik, the Beis Shmuel codified the Marik, and therefore, we cannot simply permit this woman to her husband by rejecting the Marik. The Marik is not rejectable. However, the Binyan Sion continues and says that this case differs slightly from the case of the Marik, because in the case of the Marik, so the act of adultery took place, it was under slightly different circumstances. And the Binyan Sion argues that maybe under these particular circumstances that are spelled out at such great length in the Shaila from Rabbi Mendel Friedlander, perhaps those circumstances, even the Marik would agree that the woman is permitted to her husband. But, says the Binyan Sion, and keep in mind that the Binyan Sion was one of the Gedolei Hadar, he says the consequences, the ramifications of issuing a lenient psak in these circumstances are so frightening, because it's going to be permitting a woman who's forbidden to her husband to go back to her husband. They're frightened in consequences. And therefore, he says that if two other people agree with me, then I'll be comfortable issuing a heter halacha lemaisa. But on my own, he says, I don't feel that my shoulders are broad enough alone to permit this woman to go back to her husband. As far as I'm aware, I went through a number of tshuvos on this subject, and I have not yet found, I haven't gone through all of the tshuvos yet, but I have not yet found any two people, not even one person, who actually agrees with the Aruch Lener on this. I don't know what the end of the story is, but I have to assume, based on the evidence that I have now, that the woman actually was not allowed to stay with her husband. And as the Sholom Meshiv wrote, that at least one of the musarim that we can derive from this story is that we have to be at least somewhat street smart and be able to tell when a person is being deceptive and when not. There are other musarim as well, but Lemaisa, the Aruch Lener, concluded that he wasn't willing to shoulder the responsibility for a lenient psak on his own. He only wanted to do it if other people would concur with his opinion.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.